tonight on Arena. Artemis Fowl, Radioactive and The King of Staten Island are our films up for review. And we talk to the author, Martin Walker. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Well, as it's our custom, restrictions or no restrictions, Thursday night is movie night on Arena. And we have a selection of digital releases for your consideration this evening. From Disney, the long-awaited film adaptation of Owen Colfer's world-beating novel Artemis Fowl. Saturday Night Live star Pete Davidson is out to prove he's more than Ariana Grande's ex in The King of Staten Island. And Rosamund Pike brings us Radioactive, the story of Marie Curie. Joining me now in studio is Michael Pope, and Caro Doherty is down the line. First to Artemis Fowl, which is available on Disney Plus. Cara, this is a film which has been a long time in the making, and we'll find out whether you think it's worth the wait or not shortly. But give me a brief outline of the story.
So, as you say, long time in the making. Artemis Fowl is a child prodigy who lives in Fowl Manor, this amazing house. And his father, Artemis Sr., is a very famous antiques dealer who has spent all of young Artemis's life telling him stories about magical creatures who live under the earth in Ireland, are trolls, fairies, elves, nymphs, the whole lot. And according to Artemis Junior, these have just been fairy stories. And he's now 12 years old, not really impressed by these stories anymore. But when his father mysteriously disappears, he gets the news that myths and legends are true. His father is, in fact, an antiques rescuer of items that belong to people in the fairy kingdom, and he's been liberating them from museums. And Artemis is now faced with challenging and teaming up with elves to rescue his father, who has been taken by a mysterious figure.
Okay, so let's listen to a clip. This is from very early on in the movie. Colin Farrell is Artemis, the father, and Ferdia Shaw is Artemis, the young boy, and he and his dad are having a heart-to-heart of sorts.
Did I ever tell you how all those fairy stones got to come to Fowl Manor? Thousands of years ago, this is where the peace was made. After the war between the human world and the Tuatha De Danann, a human and a fairy met right outside
those
rocks.
Just tell me when you're leaving.
The helicopter, it's being prepared for me right now, son. I'm sorry. I'll be back as soon as I can.
That's what you said the last time and the time before.
I know, Artie. There's just one very important thing I have to do. I know it's been hard, but look, my work is coming to an end. And like the stories, you know, they all have an ending that just, well, makes you smile. And this one will be no different. And when it ends, a new story will begin. And maybe, just maybe, it'll be yours.
Colin Farrell as the soon-to-be absent dad and Ferdia Shaw as Artemis in Artemis Fowl. Michael, so it's the human world and underneath is the fairy world. So the story hinges on Irish mythology, fairies and goblins. How do they explore that world?
Well, yeah, you have the home of this kind of subterranean kingdom is called the Lower Elements. So it contains all the fairies and goblins and trolls. But this isn't really like kind of, you know, spider webs and whimsy and all the stuff. That's actually more kind of tech based. It's kind of this subterranean Middle Earth meets Guardians of the Galaxy with a splash of actually the Matrix and all this kind of future tech. So it's not exactly what I was expecting from what I envisioned from what they were describing. But yeah, it's very modern looking. You know, it's trying to be a very, very contemporary take on this stuff, but it's still surrounded by a very, very kind of lethal level of Irishness.
Oh, right. But is there Irish mythology?
There is.
Or
oh, yeah,
hardly
well,
discernible?
There's the Book of Kells, as mentioned. I think at one point Artemis I is said to have stolen the Book of Kells, mentioned in the Hill of Tara. I think Artemis II, the young played by Ferdia Shaw, designed the Dublin Opera House, I believe. He's a chess champion, I think.
Yes, he's a young genius.
He's a genius.
Isn't
he's a prodigy. We're told this the whole time. We're not actually shown any of this. It's, you know, it's a short way of getting us into the adventure by just telling us this stuff.
Yes, because at the very beginning, this guy called Mulch Diggums, and he is, we see him being arrested, really, and taken off for interrogation, and he then starts telling the story of Artemas Fowl to the his interrogators. So he is the voiceover, really, for a lot of the film.
Yeah, he's doing his Batman voice. He's doing his Batman drawl. And you can tell Josh Gad is trying really, really hard. I mean, he is the comic relief, if there is such a thing in a film like this. But he's improvising a bit of the material as well. He's funny. He's a full-sized dwarf. So what he wants to do is be a regular-sized dwarf. It's pretty tricky for him. And, you know, he wants to get involved in the adventure. And he's a thief and all this kind of thing. But, yeah, his story kind of bookends the film whilst also being a narrator who has to carry quite a heavy load. He's describing this stuff for us throughout the whole movie. Very little of the kind of mythology and stuff is shown to us, or it's not really ingrained into the narrative. We're just told this stuff. We're told that Artemis is a genius. We're told how amazing his father is. We're told how incredible the fairy kingdom is. We're not really shown any of it, but Josh Gad is responsible for telling us all this stuff.
Cara, there's similarities, or people have found similarities between Artemas Fowl and Harry Potter, but Artemas Fowl is he an evil character? He's a criminal character.
He is. So they have deviated from the books. In the books, he's much more of a criminal mastermind. Here, he doesn't. He's a genius. So the mastermind part is there, but he hasn't yet become the thief that I believe he comes in the books. In this, he's a child struggling with the fact that he is a genius. So when he finds out that there's this mystical world actually alive and literally under his feet, he adapts very quickly to trying to figure out the myths of the legends and trying to find out there's a doohickey called the Oculus, and the Oculus holds the key to where his father is. It's wanted by different communities, can we call them, in the underworld. And he is smart, so he kind of figures out very quickly what he needs to do, how to do it, and which other doohickeys in his father's collection of magical watsits will help him get his dad back and get life back to relative normal, if you can call life normal when, you know, you've got trolls and fairies living underneath your house.
Okay, we'll listen to another clip. In this, Artemis's butler, Dom, finds an important document.
And he always shared his discoveries with me. The only thing he kept private was his journal.
Then that's what we have to find.
I wouldn't know where to begin to look. Could your father have ever given you a clue as to where to start?
He never told me how to start. But he may have told me how to end.
End?
Yeah. He read the same poem to me every night before bed, and every time he left. May the road rise up to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. May the rains fall soft upon your fields.
Who wrote this poem, Arte?
Nobody knows. That's just it.
Then how do you find it?
It's known as the Irish Blessing. It's a journal. It's Dad's journal.
So Ferdy Shaw there as Artemas Fowl, and Noso Anosi as the butler Dom. So he's not criminal in this. So is this a very different from the book? Do you know, Michael?
Well, I don't actually know much about the book. I did a little bit of research before seeing the film, but. Yeah, there's a lot. It's a very storied history. I think it's 8 or 9 books, which I didn't know nothing about. So all I could take really was the film on its own. Yeah,
and it is for children.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's mercifully short. It's 93 minutes, which for kind of a big tentpole.
Getting a sense, I'm not going to get a lot of love from you about this.
No,
Michael.
No, it's a flayed 93 minutes. It looks to me like it was salvaged in editing. I mean, Disney don't usually put stuff out that's not 2 hours. I mean, this is a franchise starter for them. It's dead on arrival, as far as I'm concerned. There's a kind of a siege in the middle, about 45, 50 minutes. Artemis doesn't even leave the house. It's all just kind of CGI action, hideously staged. It's barely a movie. It seems like a pilot. And before that, we have setup. And then after that, we have about another 15 minutes, even 20 minutes of sequel setup. So this is the whole, you know, the adventure just begins now. And it's
and what bothers you? Is it the Irishness of it? Or
no,
that was
or the plot or I the did, acting.
I did the whole thing. The Irishness is hard to get used to. Just as an Irishman, it is weird to for the open narration to go the most magical land of all, Ireland. It's a bit much, but as a nation, we don't really have a fragile ego with this stuff. We see it all around. It's just
but we've had many years of it.
I think as a film and as a venture, it's incredibly cynical. It's brief. It's kind of it's just a franchise starter. It doesn't even put any effort into making it kind of something that you want to see more adventures with this group of comrades. I mean, the camaraderie is so forced. They have no connection. They have no chemistry. It's just we're told after a few lines of dialogue they're buddies now, and it doesn't work. I really, really, really saw it as kind of a cynical cash grab.
Cara, were you as disappointed as Michael?
I think Michael is being a bit cynical there. I do think that if we are going to be introduced to an entirely new magical world, we do need more time to get to know the characters. We need to spend more time with them and get to know these magical creatures. And it is chopped up. It should have been a longer film. It has been edited down. And because of this, there's pieces missing. And we just jump into different scene after scene. But this was intended. The books are intended for young adults, but they made the decision to make this for much younger children. And I think if you take it in that faith that this is made by Disney for younger, like little audiences, I think they'll really enjoy the colour of it. I mean, Branagh has created a very beautiful world. Everything is quite magical and bright and bouncy. And I liked the Irishness of it because at the end of the day, it's an Irish author and it is based on Irish myth and legends. So
stars out of five, Cara?
The chopping is quite significant, but I'd go to almost a three. I can't quite give it the full three.
Almost a three. Would that be 2.5? Two and three quarters.
How about that?
Okay, that Michael, like I feel we won't reach those heights with you.
Almost a one.
Almost a one. All right, okay. Artemis Fowl at 2.75 and almost a one,
almost
is it?
Almost a one, yeah.
Okay. The King of Staten Island is the next film. It's from director Judd Apatow and starring comedian Pete Davidson. Michael, set the scene for us, please.
Yeah, Pete Davidson, SNL's Pete Davidson, plays Scott Carlin. He's kind of stuck. He's in a state of arrested development ever since his firefighter father died when he was 7. His father was a hero to him and apparently a hero to everybody else in the firefighting industry. He's in his mid-20s. He's struggling mentally. I think in the first scene, he does attempt to kill himself. And he's still living with his mother. She's an exhausted ER nurse played by Marissa Tomei. So he spends his days kind of smoking weed with his buddies and secretly sleeping with his childhood friend. But it's when his mother starts dating kind of a loudmouth firefighter, her first date in about 17 years, played by Bill Burr with a gigantic moustache, has to be seen to be believed. It kind of sets off a chain of events that will force Scott to grapple with grief and kind of take his first steps toward being an actual grown-up man as opposed to a man-child.
Okay, let's listen to a clip. Here, Scott, played by Pete Davidson, and Maud Apatow as his sister, have a conversation that goes in many directions in the space of just 1 minute.
You okay?
Michael, yeah, what do you mean, yeah?
You're going to be okay without me here?
You don't think I could survive here without you?
Okay, just don't be a dick, okay? Like, be nice to Mom, okay? Don't give her a hard time. She deserves a break.
I always give her a break. When am I going to get my break? Like,
what are you talking about? All anyone ever does is worry about you. I was ignored my entire childhood because of you.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that my childhood was so dandy.
Okay, you don't get that crazy your whole life just because Dad died, okay? At least you got to know him.
Well, you're lucky you didn't get to know him, okay? Because that's why you're almost normal. If you got to know him, you would have known that he was, like, the fucking coolest guy ever. And that would have ruined the rest of your life.
Okay, like, but what are you going to do? Are you going to get a job or are you going to leave the house?
I don't know. I'm going to open that tattoo restaurant.
No, like, for real.
I am being real. It's never been done before. I looked it up. I Googled it. It's never been done, not even as a joke.
Because no one wants to go to a restaurant and watch people get tattooed while they eat. It's gross.
It's the best idea ever. Ruby Tattoos Days, where everyone's welcome. Chicken and tattoos.
Pete Davidson as Scott and Maud Apatow as his sister in The King of Staten Island. Cara, this seems very different territory for Judd Apatow, is it?
Well, he certainly has a fondness for, did Michael just say it was man-child? He has got a fondness for man-children. So there's certainly that element. I mean, he's so many of his films are focused on a stoner guy trying to get his life sorted. But the difference in this is that it is still a comedy, but it goes down, which kind of darker roots. There's a lot more bittersweet elements to it. I mean, this is a guy who is seriously struggling. He's obviously had mental health issues from when he was very young. And the problem is he's quite likable and he has been indulged. So in some ways, his mother, not that she's fully responsible, but his mum has never really said, cop yourself on, sort your life out. They've all let him flounder in this mess until he is now in his mid-20s. So it does have that different tone in that it's not all jokes, it's not all slapdash. It certainly has the drug-smoking element that we do see in Apatow, but there's definitely a much more bittersweet tone to this than his regular films.
And Michael, this was written really with Pete Davidson in mind for a very good reason.
Mm. His father... in the story, his father was killed running into a burning building. But in the story, in real life, his father was killed in the 9/11 attacks in the World Trade Center.
And he was a firefighter. He was one of
them. He was a firefighter, yeah. So it's kind of there's the usual check marks for a Judd Apatow film. There's colourful supporting characters and bit parts, check. And there's, like, as you said, man-children refusing to grow up. And there's kind of heavily improvised natural dialogue. But it definitely has more of a kind of an empathy and a genuineness to it than, say, This Is 40 or Funny People, which was kind of Judd Apatow and his buddies kind of making comedies. I'm not a fan of Judd Apatow's movies. I like my film. As you may have guessed from my first review, I like structure. I like coherent storytelling. And I've always found Judd Apatow's films to be kind of overlong, unfocused. They're very improvised. They're kind of rambling, and it's always kind of the odd scene. It feels like, what was the point of that? Felt irrelevant. But this one has enough kind of, in its spirit, it has enough generosity in it to kind of carry it forward. As per his record, it's over 2 hours. It's 2 hours and 10 minutes, which is, depending on your personal taste, if you like that kind of thing and kind of spending time with this man-child, you know, there's a lot to like. Not perfect, but there's a lot to like.
Cara, there's a lot of focus, obviously, on Pete Davidson and his performance in this. And it's, I mean, obviously, given his experience, he definitely has that emotion in him. Is he able to bring it to the part?
I think that he is. I mean, I have to say, I wasn't particularly a fan of him before this. I know he's big on Saturday Night Live and that kind of thing. Didn't really get his comedy. But now seeing this and realising how much of this is his own experience, I think he really shows this. He's quite self-depreciating. He really knows that he is very flawed and would like to change, but he really hasn't a clue how to. And I think that he brings this lovely, I guess, yeah, he's a sweet guy who really is suffering, has no idea how to change things and would like help. And I really think that this is going to be a start for Davidson, kind of moving into an entirely different type of work from now on.
And Michael, there is a great supporting cast. We said Marisa Tomei, and then there's Steve Buscemi as well.
Yeah, Steve Buscemi plays kind of like the patriarch of the firefighters. He's called Papa. And yeah, he's great. He's not in it. I wish he was in it more, because in the second half, it kind of switches gears. The first half, you are kind of like, his mother is indulging him, and he's kind of like this feckless loser, and he's aware that he's messed up. But yeah, but in the second half, Scott moves into the firehouse because he's got nowhere to live, because his mother takes the step, you know, you're out of here. And you get to know Bill Burr's character, who's in a really good performance, kind of tough love, burly working class man from Staten Island.
This is the mother's new girl, boyfriend.
This is the moustache, as I'll refer to him from now on. And you kind of, once the dynamic shifts and he moves into the firehouse, then you start to see, then you really start to see that this is a young man who doesn't have the tools to reconcile that he lost his father, who he considered a hero, but in actual fact, and he's told this by the by his father's old colleagues, that he was an actual real life hero. But what he needs to know is that his father was a hero, but he was also as flawed and as messed up as he was. And I think, yeah, it does work. The second half is definitely stronger than the first, I thought, but yeah, it really works.
I think you're moving away from 1 out of 5.
I am.
I feel at least 2.
Yeah, and in fact, my score at a tier, I'm actually going to put up a 0.5, because I do actually, hearing some of the dialogue there, I did realise that it is a good movie to spend time with these characters. Now, there's nothing really that cynical about it. It's warm.
What is that?
3.5.
And you, Cara?
I'm going to go to the fore. I think that it really is. It's heartfelt. It's funny. And I think it just deals with mental health issues in a way that we don't often see on screen. So
very good mark for me. For the King of Staten Island. Now, Cara, you alone have seen the final film tonight. It's called Radioactive and it's directed by Marjan Satrapi, if I could pronounce that correctly. It tells the story of Marie Curie, played by Rosamund Pike. Obviously a fascinating character, the woman who, with her alone and with her husband, discovered polonium and radium.
Yeah, so we see from early days when Marie Curie moved to Paris. The film actually opens when she's dying. She's on her deathbed, and that's in 1934. And we flash back through her life as she's seeing it in her final hours. So we see her when not long after she left Poland. She was Maria Skłodowska. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. She moved to Paris because she knew that's where she had to be if she was going to be a successful scientist. She also knew that she was in a man's world and she was not in any way going to let this stop her. She was going to stand up to them. She was going to be heard. She was going to make her discoveries no matter what they said. The problem with all of this was they wouldn't finance her to have a really good laboratory, and that's what she needed. They thought, you have merit, but we're not financing a woman. And that was when she met Pierre Curie, a scientist who was not in any way threatened by the fact that she was a female and supported her work. And he offered her a workspace where she could create the great things that she knew was in her head, but that she wouldn't find without having that laboratory support.
All right, so let's listen to Marie, played by Rosamund Pike, and Sam Riley as Pierre Curie, almost collaborating in the lab.
You've been frowning at that all week.
I'm observing.
What are you looking for?
I find it easier to observe when I'm not talking. I measure uranium and I discover less radiations than I do in its ore.
The ore is more powerful than the element.
Exactly. And I can't
quite work.
There must
be some anomaly in the results.
I've run the same test 6 times. I get identical results. My instinct is that there is another element that's skewing the results.
You think you found an undiscovered element?
If you're laughing at me, then I'm...
No, I'm not laughing at you. That's exciting. Measuring equipment's useless.
It's worked perfectly fine for me so far.
If we're going to get the figures you need, we need something that's capable of extreme precision.
There is no we.
You need something that's capable of measuring microscopic aspects of
energy.
No,
please,
yes.
No.
I have an idea. Follow me.
I can smell the Bunsen burner. Marie, they're played by Rosamund Pike, and Sam Riley is playing Pierre Curie. So she sounds like a feisty woman. I guess she had to be, given the world she found herself in and being so brilliant in.
Absolutely. Feisty is mild, which is a chemical equation in her own right. I think it seems like it was her personality, partly, but also she knew what she could do, what she was capable of being. And there was no way she was going to get that without being extraordinarily determined. At times she would come across as quite rude. But the thing that I really enjoy about this, we often see male geniuses portrayed as arrogant, bad-tempered, egotistical. And that's fine because they're male geniuses and that's how they are. Women are so rarely seen as that. You don't really get the chance to see a woman who is argumentative and cold at times. And in this, Marjan Satrapi has made that decision to show, do you know what? This is what this woman was. It doesn't take away from her being a woman that she was cold and that she was cantankerous and that she was bold. She's rather unruly. And they've really run with this idea that, you know, that she was who she was and she was an amazing, amazing woman. And whether people liked that or not, it didn't matter. Her invention in some ways changed the course of history.
And Cara, how does it work dramatically? You know, a biopic can be fascinating or it can be, you know, kind of get caught up in its own narrative.
I think we have great performances. Rosamund Pike, I don't know when she doesn't turn in a good performance. She's vibrant. She plays her like a force of nature. The relationship between her and the husband and wife has a lovely feel to it. She softens when she's around him, and it's quite beautifully kind of mixed. The one issue that I would have is that they have a lot of flash forwards. They go into the future so we can see what becomes of radiation. We see scenes in Chernobyl. We see it being first used to treat cancer patients. This doesn't really fit with the narrative of the rest of the film. It kind of takes you out of it, sends you forward. And I don't think those elements are necessary. I can see what Marianne Satrapi wanted to achieve by them. She wants people to know that these the consequence of radioactivity, but it just doesn't fit. Take those out and there's a solid biopic in there.
I feel very Marie Curie now, but could you put that into a mathematical form out of five?
Right, out of five, A plus B equals 3 stars.
Three, so 3 out of 5 for Radioactive. Michael Pope and Caro Doherty, thank you very much. Artemis Fowl, The King of Staten Island and Radioactive are on general release on digital platforms. In June of 1832, a cholera epidemic hit the town of Charleville in County Cork. It had made its way through Europe and its arrival sparked devastation and death. But along with that came panic, conspiracy theories and unconventional cures. Now as part of the Cork Midsummer Festival, an online artwork will explore the connection between cholera and COVID between now and then. The piece is called Day of the Straws and I'm joined by its creators, artist Marie Brett and writer Katie Holly. Marie, how did cholera come to Ireland? It came from Europe, but did it come from further afield?
I think in the story that I uncovered, The Day of the Straws, it was very much just located that it arrived from continental Europe and it didn't go in any further in terms of how it had arrived, which is kind of interesting. And talking with a lot of the community members in Cork and further afield and with historians, some people were saying that they believed it arrived on the shores of Ireland from an Italian ship, but it wasn't ever mentioned in the Day of the Straws story, which is interesting.
And where did you find the story, or was it something that you were aware of?
No, it was a new discovery for me. I'd done a big project with Cork Midsummer the year before called Cultural Law, and I suppose that was the kind of the seedling for doing more research into particular areas in terms of, I suppose, looking at what resonance kind of traditional Irish law would have in today's times. And when the festival invited me, you know, to explore the area a little bit more with in terms of potential and doing research, I came across the Day of the Straws quite by chance. It's kind of fascinating because it isn't a very well-known story at all. But I came upon it kind of researching a new project that would leap on from cultural law, really.
Right. So the cholera came in to the north and worked its way down. But then in Cork, there was also talk of were people dying straight away, or how did it affect them? What does cholera do to you?
Well, I suppose in terms of making it as an art piece in responding to the story, it was very much looking at the protective cure that might be on offer through the Day of the Straws story. So I think that's the approach we've taken in terms of in the artwork shall I tell you a little bit about the story in terms of how it, I suppose, how people believed in the potential folk cure, that what it was that there was an apparition. So it was a holy apparition appeared in Charleville Church, as you said, in County Cork, and under her feet were certain ashes.
It was Our Lady appeared.
Exactly. It was said to be the Virgin Mary, exactly. And she described, it's kind of written that she warned that the ashes were the only protection for people against cholera. And then it's written that the people that were there, and I believe it was 4 people, She said that they should gather up the ashes that were under her feet and then take them to four neighbouring houses. And then they, in turn, should take them to another four houses and so on. And I think what's really interesting is that as people carried them the message northward up the country, that protective magical material changed. And so ash became turf. And then, in turn, in different parts of the country, it became stones. And then, apparently, kind of westward, it was straw that was used. And I think I found it really interesting that part of the account that was sent to Dublin Castle from a major general describes it as kind of mass hysteria, with people raging from one end of the country to the other, carrying this protective natural material. And this was all within the space of a week, and it was actually the middle week of June, so we're very close to the time, all that time ago. And from Cork, the chain of messengers had reached all the way up to the borders of Ulster. So I suppose for me, in terms of discovering the story, I love this idea of the essence of the story in terms of hope and protection, really.
And how did the church react to this? Did they believe the people that they had seen the apparition of the Virgin Mary?
It's very mixed in terms of there's not very much written about it. And I with Katie, we both spoke to the Historical Society in Charleville and they did some more research as well. And it seems to be, there was great faith. So it's kind of pre-famine time. And I think it's in the sense of now, in terms of the church believing or not believing, there's kind of very mixed opinion. And it's quite interesting to hear that, in the sense that some people see it as a myth. And other people see it that they totally believe that this is the truth. And they're saying that in Charleville, that denominationals were founded after the apparition. So new religious orders were kind of founded in the town. So they take that as kind of evidence that it did happen. But then, I suppose this is part of the kind of the beauty of the story, in a way, in terms of what people make of it now as much as what people made of it back then.
So, Katie Holly, it's a fantastic story. How did you go about writing it then?
Well, I didn't kind of write it in any terms of narrative, but the story was so interesting that it automatically kind of breeds a response to it. Do you know what I mean? Because it's, I suppose, about the nature of physical and mental health and well-being and how they're communicated through a narrative and through faith and through spirituality and through folklore and folk medicine.
Do you mean like the panic people? Do you mean like the panic people felt and the distress people felt for this disease hitting them?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and how that can be mirrored now and reflected now in similar situations. You know, we don't like using the term, but fake news about things that may work in order to prevent COVID, but may also not work and may be destructive. You know, so it's a very interesting area of study, and I'm delighted to have found out about the story, because I'm actually from Charleville and had never heard the story before. And I had once Marie and the Cork Midsummer Festival approached me about the project, I obviously started asking people that I know in Charleville, and nobody seemed to know about it there either. So it's really exciting that there are these stories that are still to be discovered. So that's a massive area of interest for me.
I mean, there are some similarities between then and now. It's kind of the unknown and it's coming from Europe. But what other connections do you see between then and now?
I suppose the human responses, there is that panic and that need for survival and to make sure that you're safe. And there's also the questioning of a deity and, you know, turning to your faith for solace and for support. And I think that's another area that we're very interested in, is finding hope through the making of this artwork in a very difficult time for everyone. And that this country has gone through several times before. We had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Ida Milne, the historian, who's written a book about the Spanish flu and about some of the social rituals and things that happened during that time in 1918 to 1922. So this isn't the first time this country has gone through it. And there's a lot of similarities, you know.
What kind of rituals did they go through then?
Well, I was very surprised to find out from Ida that they actually did know a lot about the need for sanitation and for washing your hands. And there are apparently, now there's no photos of people in Ireland apparently, but abroad during the Spanish flu, there were people covering their faces. So I didn't realise that they had that information already. So that's something that obviously we're mirroring now, and that, you know, there's a lot of mask wearing and people not sure about wearing masks and what type of masks and all that kind of information has got quite jumbled as well. So we're looking at the distress that's caused by that, by the complexity of the communications and lack of information, do you know?
And what is the work going to be then?
So it's very much a work in progress at the moment, but it's really going to be visual, audio and text. So Marie is the visual artist. So it'll be it's artwork that she's creating and videos that she's collated. There's also it might consist of audio on certain sections of the site, conversations recorded with the many people that Marie and myself have been chatting to from the community, and historians and storytellers and healers and academics. And we're also looking at the possibility of having an actor perform some dramatizations of some of my responses to the material. So, for example, I'm working on a monologue imagined from someone who was there during Day of the Straws and was going to their neighbour about this possible potential preventative method for cholera, or a nurse leaving a voicemail after a long day working in an intensive care unit right now. Mm-hmm. So these kind of audio responses are something we're working on. And then in terms of my own response to it, like today I was working on a modern fairy tale in the style of an Irish folktale, to tell children about what COVID is, because children have had to learn new words that we never knew at their age, like the word infected or the word antibodies, which can be very frightening. And I'm obviously very, as a writer, I'm very interested in language. So I was also working on something for a WhatsApp conversation between two people who are trying to decipher the truth between the things they've heard about preventative methods for COVID.
And Marie, it sounds so visual, you know, those ideas of the procession and people going with the ashes or else with the straw. What are the visuals going to look like?
I think that we're kind of reaching for quite an otherworldly kind of atmosphere in the work. So there's a lot of digital moving image work that then's been frozen framed. So there's like two layers, so you can kind of see something of the past and something potentially of the future. And we're reaching for that visually. So it's like almost a collision of I suppose, hope and belief and anxiety and worry all mixed in together. And I suppose it's a bit like thinking of it like a series of rooms that a visitor, it'd be a kind of custom-built website that a visitor will be kind of guided through and around, sort of taken on a journey, almost led by the hand through and around a series of rooms and overhearing a kind of series of conversations or encounters. So we're looking at something that's quite rich and layered, very textured visually, with kind of symbolism of folklore and ritual, as well as the kind of modern-day things that we're seeing very much on social media and on the news all the time. So a kind of a mixture of both.
Well, that sounds fascinating. My thanks to Marie Brett and Katie Holly. Day of the Straws will be online at corkmidsummer.com on June the 21st at 12 noon. Joining me now is Martin Walker, a prize-winning journalist and historian who has worked as foreign correspondent in Moscow for the Guardian newspaper. He is author of several acclaimed works of non-fiction, including The President They Deserve, The Rise, Fall and Comeback of Bill Clinton. But he is possibly best known for his series on the Dordogne mysteries set in Perigeux, a region of rural France. Books which follow the cases of the beloved detective Bruno Courage, chief of police. The latest of these, A Shooting at the Chateau Rock, is book 13 in the series. Martin, you're very welcome to Arena.
It's grand to be with you.
For those of us not familiar with the Dordogne mysteries, can you tell us what drew a Russian correspondent of The Guardian to this area of France?
Well, my wife and I, we'd been foreign correspondents around the world. And at one point, my wife said, look, we've got two daughters. We need to have a place where they can have some roots. This was back about over 20 years ago. And we got this place in the Perigord, in the Dordogne, initially as a kind of a holiday home, but it's now become really the family home. And I was so lucky in that my local neighbours and friends took me down to the rugby club because they knew I'd played rugby, and the tennis club. And I began playing tennis there, sort of, you know, middle-aged tennis. And one of the chaps that I was playing with had been 10 years in the French army. He was a hunter. He was a very good cook. He spent his spare time playing tennis, or teaching the kids to play tennis and rugby of the village. And he was our village policeman. And I thought, we've got here a wonderful character. I've got to start writing about this extraordinary man. And I did so, and well, here we are, 13 books later and 18 languages, and gosh, I mean, it's just sort of taken over my life a bit.
And how did your friends and that particular friend that you model Bruno on in the Périgord, how did they take to you writing about them?
Well, initially there was a little bit of concern, and I was rather nervous when the book started to come out in French. Because in the past, you know, when we had a new novel came out, I'd invite my friends, my French friends, to dinner. My wife would do a great meal. I'd get out some very good wine. And after the first course, I'd tap the glass and say, well, dear friends, you know, we're here to celebrate the launch of a new Bruno. And in this novel, I write about the beauty of the women of the Périgord and the wise people. Yes, yes, Martin, more wine, more wine. Then came the first one in French, and I thought, "Oh God, they're going to get very nervous about this." But in fact, they adore it, and we've now got every summer until the COVID, the virus came. We've had readers from Germany, Sweden, Japan, Korea, France, Italy, and they come into our village market and they look around for a policeman. And they'll go up to him and say, are you Bruno? And he's asked me for various words in foreign languages. He will say to the Germans, jawohl! And he'll salute and he'll sign the books and he will hug the wife and take selfies with her. He's become a tourist icon, so he's very pleased, and the local people are pleased. I mean, the French government seem pretty pleased because they've given me a gold medal for my services to tourism. So everybody seems quite happy about this, and in fact, it's hard not to like this character Bruno, because he hates to carry a gun, he doesn't like arresting people, he knows everybody in the area, you know, he's danced with all the wives at the wedding, he's at their weddings, he's been at their christenings, he's helped to carry the coffin when the great grandfather dies. Everybody knows Bruno, and they all like him.
And he loves cooking, and he loves his wine.
He adores his wine. He is a very good cook. And because of all the food I put in these books, I was asked by my publishers to start producing cookbooks. And we produced the first cookbook, Bruno's cookbook, came out in Europe. And it won this prize as World's Best French Cookbook for 2015. Which came as a great shock to the French, the idea that, you know,
that you could do that, yeah.
would do this. But in fact, they were very welcoming people here. So when they realized that I loved my wine, they said, okay, we have this organization in the Bergerac called the Consulat de la Vigne de Bergerac, the Consulate of Wines. And it was founded in the year 1254. Which is what, 750 years ago and more. And I'm the first Scotsman in these 750 years to have been elected a Grand Consul. And this means I've got the right to go into every vineyard in the whole of the Bergerac and taste and test the wines. And to, you know, it's a tough job, but somebody has to do this.
This life of yours, I don't know how you can get to write a book sober anyway. Martin, you're a historian as well as being, an expert in politics. And you've really dug down into the history of this wonderful area, which has like a history dating back to the Neanderthals. And it's got beautiful cave art which you have featured in your books. I mean, is that what you're looking out for as a novelist, that you start with the history and then you think, how could I fit Bruno into this wonderful landscape you've created?
Well, in a way, the history came first, because the first novel that I produced was a couple of years before Bruno. It was called The Caves of Perigord. And it was about this amazing masterpiece of cave art called Lascaux, which is in the same valley where I live. It's just up the river. And it's when Picasso first saw it, when it was rediscovered in the year 1940, he was brought down to see it. And he came out and said, "We have met our masters. We have learned nothing in all of these thousands of years." And, you know, if I walk out of my house in one direction, I go over a stone bridge, and a very old bridge, and up through a village, and I come to a place called La Ferrassie. And that is the first place that we know that human beings buried one another with ritual and respect. And it's 72,000 years old. And the fact that the woman who was there, she had, that the archaeologists found pollen around her neck, it meant that she was buried with flowers around her neck. I mean, my heart just sort of overflows when I come across this kind of stuff.
Yes.
I go in another direction from my house, and I come to this old hilltop village called Limay, and we know that Julius Caesar's legion stormed it over 2,000 years ago. They then built a fort there, and the archaeologists found at Limay, they found a cache of hundreds of small flat stones, each of them engraved with a different animal, a mammoth or an eagle or a horse. And the only explanation they could come up with was why there were so many of these things, was that it was the world's first art school where people learned how to engrave these particular animals. You cannot not be moved by this kind of place.
Now, as I said, you were stationed in Moscow when you worked with The Guardian as a correspondent there, and so you're an expert in all things Putin and oligarchs. So I suppose it's no surprise that the Russians have seeped their way into your latest novel, The Shooting at Chateau Rock. But there were particular incidences. One, I think, that we might have dealt with this week. We were talking about the Salisbury poisonings.
Yeah, well, a number of things were taking place. There was. Remember the Putin's people invaded. First of all, they took over the Crimea. Then they took over Ukraine. These people who were working for Putin in the Ukraine shot down a Malaysian airliner with over 200 Dutch people aboard. We had the nerve agent being used in Salisbury in Britain. And it was clear that something very, very disturbing was taking place in the way that Russia felt it could deal with European countries. Then I came across this case of this extraordinary woman, Maria Caruana, in Malta, an investigative journalist who was blown up in her car because she was investigating the way that some of the small European countries were in effect selling European citizenship to Russian oligarchs who were able to pay enough money. And I felt that this too was a kind of an attack upon European values. So I tried to bring these things in. I'm not a natural fiction writer. I'm not a natural novelist. I'm enough of a journalist. I want to bring in real things that I can describe, that I know about, in the same way I want to describe what it's like to be hunting or to find truffles in the earth in the Perigord, or what it's like to be able to taste a particular kind of wonderful Perigord dish. I want to get this sense of reality into my novels as well.
You also, we here in Ireland, as you know, it's a beautiful country as well, and we have a beautiful village called Dalkey, where Bono lives, and recently Matt Damon came to stay there. Yeah. So I guess the beautiful area you live in, France, also attracts rock star types, which also play a part in this novel.
Well, they do indeed, and that goes back to something. Back in the early 70s, when the world was young and so was I was a young reporter on The Guardian, and I went to the editor and said, "Look, we're not writing anything about rock music, and it's the most important cultural thing for people of my age." And the editor said, "Well, Martin, why not write about it in your spare time? You carry on doing your political journalism and so on, but in your spare time, do what you want. So I had this wonderful time. I was there at the premiere of The Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd at the London Planetarium. I interviewed David Bowie when he launched Lad Insane. I interviewed Mick Jagger. I went on tour with Boko Haram. I had a whale of a time. And I knew that some of these old rockers had, like David Gilmour at Pink Floyd, had got themselves places, small chateaus and so on in the Périgord. So I used that as another theme in this particular novel. So I could write a bit about music as well, which means so much to me. And I draw constantly upon the reality of my life here in France, or my background in you know, political journalism, international journalism with The Guardian when I was running UPI. And I use all of that because that's what I am. I'm as much of a journalist as I am a much more a journalist, I think, than a novelist. So
yeah, Martin, that even affects you when you're naming your chickens. Could you tell us the name of your chickens?
Well, when I first began keeping chickens here, I got a cockerel. And at the time, the president of France was Sarkozy. So the cockerel is called Sacco. And he came with four hens. So we called them. The first one was, excuse me, the first one was Carla Bruni, which was, of course, Sarkozy's wife, the pretty one. Then there was the tyrant, the bully, the hen who was always first to eat and push the others aside. That was Margaret Thatcher. Then there was the talkative one who kept running around, very energetic, so she became Hillary Clinton. And the final one, the white one, was Angela Merkel, who gives the most eggs. What can I say?
Well, Bruno also has chickens, so, and you can read all about Bruno in Martin Walker's new book. It's called A Shooting at the Chateau Rock. Martin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's it for tonight's Arena. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy were the researchers. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Olam McGowan.